Support for this program is made possible in part by USI Outreach and Engagement, where USI is partnering with local startups collaborating on launching new ventures. More information at usi.edu/community.
Buenas tardes. Good afternoon. I'm your host, Paola Marisan, and this is The Trend on WNIN-FM. This week, we are discussing the origin of ISIS and the impact they've had on Syria. In a recent panel presentation, Imam Omar Atia discussed with students of the University of Evansville how a country previously permitting freedom of religion was transformed by an outside group, causing an environment of religious intolerance. After covering the imam's work in the community, WNIN continues to shine light on the interfaith movement developing in Evansville.
Very excited to be here, and I'm going to try to smile extra wide for this first slide because I think the smile is going to start going away because of the pain that comes with the subject. Don't look at my face throughout the presentation as an angry Muslim face like you see on TV. It's just the subject matter. Any question is welcome, and please interrupt me at any time. The first thing I'd like to say, and I normally never give disclaimers or qualifiers before I speak on a subject because we're just taught not to do that. But I feel like I have to on this one because I don't think it's fair to call anyone really an expert on this specific concept, this concept of the religious impact or the impact of religion on the conflict in Syria. And the reason is because it's an extremely complex situation. And anyone who tries to oversimplify it or to simplify it is probably doing a disservice to people that are trying to understand it well. But what I will speak from is three sets of experiences. One is my experience living first and then going back and forth to the Middle East for business purposes recently. And then the second is my intimate relationship, friendships with various Syrian Americans, including, obviously, and then the third, which is including members of our congregation. And so in putting this presentation together, I didn't come up with all this content on my own. I give credit to a lot of the people that go to our congregation here in Evansville that are Syrian American. And I also give credit to a lot of people who wrote on the subject because I had to honestly see what everyone is saying on this subject. From my standpoint, I had my opinion. I had what I had analyzed as the role of religion. But it's a lot more than what you would hear in one article or see on the surface. So that's the first qualifier. So the first way I did this is to look at it as a set of questions, the questions that come to mind when people think of the subject. And so the first question is, did the conflict begin as a religious conflict? And so the first thing I'll do when I ask these questions is ask you guys, what do you think? The idea is that it did not start as a religious conflict because there was no religious conflict per se. And there's a caveat that we'll come to in a few questions and a few slides that I'll explain in terms of, was there a religious divide in the country of Syria? But by everyone that you ask, anyone who's Syrian, anyone who's experienced living in Syria or talking to Syrians or working with Syrians, there wasn't that level of any kind of need for there to be a separation between people of different sects or religion in Syria. The reality is that people before this conflict lived together in harmony, sometimes not even knowing what religion or sect a person was from. I had one person who was an older person and a father of one of the members of the community specifically tell me that for a long time, he had people who worked in his business. He didn't know who was Shia and who was Sunni. The person who managed his finances was a Christian, and the concept of him being Christian never came up versus Muslim. He was trusted with and he made it a point to let me know, he was trusted with the most important job in the business, which is handling the cash, because almost everything at that time was with cash. And so the idea was never that there was a separation between people based on religion. Then came 2011, and to the rest of the world, people who weren't living in the Middle East or closely experiencing the Middle East, the Arab Spring was out of nowhere. You know, people all of a sudden woke up and decided that dictatorship and oppression was not a good idea anymore. and they decided to revolt, and that's obviously not how it worked. How it worked is that there were always these undercurrents of people not accepting the situation. And in 2011, after a few years of experience with social media and how to leverage social media and so on, then there was this movement that ended up being in the form of civil unrest, in the form of rising up against the status quo of the regimes, starting with, of course, Tunisia, then Egypt, and then Syria. At that time, I remember that when there was the civil unrest in Egypt, friends of mine that were Syrian who were not apolitical people, they were people who were politically savvy, said to me, and these were people who weren't my generation, they were a slightly older generation, said to me, there's no way this will ever happen in Syria. Because we don't have that kind of problem with our regime in Syria, and we don't have that kind of problem of classes in Syria. But that's the thing, is that some people didn't feel this undercurrent, some people did. And it was mainly about those who did not have versus those who had. Those who were okay, functioning okay, from what the regime was doing in terms of their personal lives, and those who were not okay. And so it was really about the regime versus the people. Where religion played in that, we'll talk about a little bit later. So now, is it a religious conflict? This is where people debate, and you'll get all kinds of opinions. I would say that yes, it is turned into now what is considered a religious conflict, depending on the definition. And the reason is because now there are lines that have been drawn. And these lines that have been drawn aren't about regime versus people. These lines are about camps that are based on not just Sunni and Shi'i, but it's what type of Sunni, what type of Shi'i. And then in the middle, there's people who don't want religion and who feel that religion is the cause of all of this. And then, of course, there's now that it's completely militarized, it's about which group will get the power. And so even within some of these groups, there's subgroups. So the question is, and this is the one I do want people to answer because it's not yes or no, is when do you think it turned religious? When did it turn into a religious conflict? Or what caused it to turn into a religious conflict?
Media.
Okay, tell me more.
I think that there has been a lot of emphasis, maybe wrongly placed on the significance of Islam in this situation just because of ISIS in itself, having that as part of its name. I think that in people's mind equates to religion.
Okay. So potentially to the rest of the world, it's now looking like a religious conflict because some of the groups are claiming religion as their reason for fighting.
And I also think the way our media portrays it as a regional conflict, and we talk about Iran backing Assad because it's a Shia state versus maybe Saudi Arabia doesn't want to intervene against ISIS because they're both Sunni, things like that. So I think the media has tried to portray it more as like a Shia-Sunni conflict on a regional scale.
Yes. And so here's the difficult and complex explanation. And of course, I'm very open to contention of this. So even though it is likely incited by propaganda and media, not just around the world of the situation, but in the situation and in the Middle East, it has turned into, unfortunately, where a lot of the people involved believe it to be a faith conflict. And the unfortunate piece of that is, if you were there a couple of slides ago, it never was about that. But now it's turned into that. And for some people for whom it was never about that, now it's turned into that. And so the question is, how can that happen? How can that happen that for a people who, to them, they weren't separating between each other or separating themselves based on their religion, now they're separating themselves based on religion? Yes.
The terrible pressures and strains from inside and outside are causing people to side with one view or another. I heard B.F. Skinner, he was a psychologist, an important psychologist, once say that it's easy to be gracious and kind and sharing and everything else if you live in a country where you have a whole lot. But if you're in a situation, no matter where you are, where you're denied a lot and you're having to try to cope, that these kinds of things can happen. You know, things that were bubbling under the surface rise up. And at various times, there have been all kinds of religious conflicts in every country.
That gets to the heart of it. What happened is, so Syria always had this diversity. And Syria had a unique diversity that many other Middle Eastern countries don't have. So Egypt has a large minority of Christians, for instance. But the whole rest of the population, 88 to 90% of the population, is Sunni Muslim. And then you have 10 to 12% Christian. And that's it. And for the most part, religion, there aren't that many groups. What happened in Syria is there was a manipulation of the diversity to turn it into, and that goes into how did the regime look at or treat or use religion before the conflict started. What happened is the regime started with an avoidance of religion, basically getting people to accept that Islam, the Islam that is allowed to be practiced, is an apolitical Islam. And the thing about the faith of Muslims, is that it's understood by Muslims who have learned the religion deeply that it can't be void of politics because of the fact that politics has to do with governing the affairs of people. And in governing the affairs of people, there is justice and there's injustice. There's oppression and there's liberation. And by default, the human is born liberated, is born free. And anything that oppresses or causes oppression is considered wrong in the faith. And people are encouraged to do whatever it takes to ensure the freedom of all. To contradict what most people believe Islam preaches, it's about ensuring freedom of religion. It's about ensuring freedom of practice of religion. It's about ensuring all the freedoms that we, for instance, in the U.S. take for granted and hold dear. Not only is it important in the faith that those are existent among people, the faith encourages that people should fight for that. At the same time, the faith encourages avoidance of anything that causes blood. And so the Prophet, peace and blessings upon him, Muhammad, has traditions where he clearly says, those who start rebellion are wrong, are wrongdoers. So those who incite rebellion are wrongdoers. And he also has traditions that are authentic and that are clear that talk about those who should stand to an unjust ruler, and that the one who stands against an unjust ruler, even if it means losing his life, will actually be the best of martyrs on the day of resurrection. This is a very clear tradition. So one should do everything, and then he says, if one sees injustice, he or she should do everything in her power. First, if she's able to do something materially to change it, she has to. It's not an option. Our faith teaches it's not an option that you should do something materially to change injustice. You have to. And if you can't do something materially, it's not possible, the conditions that you're in don't allow you to do something materially, you have to at least speak about it and write about it so that you raise people's awareness to the injustice. And then if you can't do that, you have to hate it in your heart and wish for the conditions to change so that you can write or speak about it and then try to change it materially. These two concepts are very clear. What happened during the time of dictatorship in the Middle East? Which of these traditions do you think became known? The first one, anti-rebellion. To the extent that people became almost unaware of the other traditions in the faith, of the balance of that tradition. There's, for instance, an example that a lot of people who try to raise awareness to this liberation mentality that they speak about, they say that the successor, one of the second successor to the Prophet, his name is Omar, his nickname was the differentiator, or the difference maker between wrong and right. One time, when he took the successorship. He stood on the pulpit, and he tried because he had heard that people were scared of him, that he was very tall, he had a large stature, and he was known to be very firm in his decisions. So he had heard people were could be scared of him, and he was told this by some of his advisors. And so he got worried. And what he got worried about was the following. He stood on the pulpit and he said, "What would you say if I started to worry about my own benefit out of this role that I have, that I started to worry about my own benefit just a little bit?" And then he waited. And everyone was quiet. And then there was one man who looked around and he saw everyone was quiet. And he wasn't one of the known advisors or one of the close people to Omar. He stood up. And he said, "What did you say, O commander of the believers?" Because that's what they called him. And he said, "What would you say if I looked for my families and my benefit just a little bit as I was in this role?" And he said, "By God, if you looked to the benefit of your family or yourself just a little bit, we would cut your neck just a little bit." And he said, he yelled at him as loud as he could, and he said, "What did you say?" And he said, very firmly, "By God, if you look to your own benefit just a little bit, we would take our swords and cut off your head just a little bit." And he said, "Praise be to God that he made in my followers people who would set me aright when I start to be wrongly guided." So this is a very clear tradition. There's no difference of opinion about this tradition from Omar's legacy. But it was gone. And anyone who would talk about it, the next day, they would be in the central intelligence services of Egypt or Syria or whatever country it was. And they wouldn't just be there for a visit. They would be there for some very intimate torture, very frankly. And there's people that are friends of mine, that are relatives of mine, that have been through that torture. And I'm very aware of it in Egypt. And they were through. Some of them were through that torture, not for any activism. It was for a political connection to Islamic centers. They would go to the dawn prayer on a regular basis. After about 20 days of going to the dawn prayer, which the dawn prayer is considered a very hard prayer for people, especially young men or young women, to go to because it's very early in the morning. So the assumption was that if someone is willing to wake up that early, he is likely to do something for his religion that could threaten the status quo. So you have this. And so this is the situation that people were dealing with. And then at the same time in Syria, in addition to that complication, in addition to this complication, that oppression was being done in the name of the faith. In Syria, in addition to that, you had a ruling minority of a sect. And while they didn't benefit everyone from that sect, the only people they would benefit had to qualify through the filter of being part of that sect. What I mean by that is the ruling party was specifically of the Alawite sect. There were still very impoverished Alawites. There were still people who were part of the uprising, the civil disobedience or the civil unrest that were from every sect, including the Alawites. However, those who were benefiting were only benefiting if they were Alawites. Benefiting meaning through the corruption of the regime. And so as a result, that didn't come out in the first layer. But then when the regime started to oppress the civil unrest, what happened is the response to what the regime did to those who rose up in peace was, as you know, was a strong, unjust, militarized response. And because the militarized response was done at the hands of the ruling minority, some started to blame the entire minority. And when some started to blame the entire minority, that was the start of the slippery slope of breaking the masses apart. And once it became militarized, the militarization became easier for those who were rising up to leverage faith, and especially those parts of faith that I talked about that were the second parts, in order to rally people to support the uprising against this now militarized squashing of an uprising that was originally peaceful. So that all complicated. So now you have faith as the basis that in order to rally people more readily to respond to this militarized suppression. And as a result, it was much now quicker of a dividing of the people. All of this happened in the span of 1 to 2 years. One would say that how can it go from no difference between people to in less than 1 to 2 years that people are completely separated and militarized against each other because of their religious division lines. I remind you of the current polarization we have in our nation. If the current polarization we have in our nation turned into a militarized version, what would happen? What happens when humans now are being attacked, not just name-calling, and you can see what happens in name-calling for those who are purporting to be presidential, let alone what would happen if just us, everyday people, would start to be have name-calling against us. Now take it to the level of killing each other's families. If I can't reach the one who killed my family directly, I will try to reach who I presume to be part of their group. We're not significantly far in America because we're claiming that we should stop certain people from coming into the country. So I'm saying that's our version of an us versus them, and I'm not trying to push my agenda of having you understand that an us versus them is that detrimental, but there was already an undercurrent of trying to blame those differences for smaller things that obviously existed in Syria because it exists everywhere in the world. So when I said there weren't those divisions, they were the same types of diversity noticing that happens in a community like ours. We would never fathom to be militarized against each other based on our differences in America, right? We wouldn't even ever think about something like that. But what happened in Syria didn't happen to us. And we still have an us versus them. So what I'm saying is, you had this mild us versus them that existed but never affected anything meaningful. Then when the civil, and something that brought people together was this peaceful uprising, because everyone joined hands. In Egypt, for instance, during the Arab Spring, the Muslims who were protesting in 2011 were being protected during their prayer because the military would take advantage when the Muslims would start praying that they would start attacking. And so what happened is the Christians and the protesters would protect the Muslims while they prayed. That's how one people it was, because they had one mission that they all rallied around. And so the regime saw this in Syria and had something that it could manipulate and was ready to manipulate that in Egypt wasn't possible or was less possible, but became possible now, of course, in Egypt a little less scale. All of this is how the regime dealt with religion since 2011. So the regime had an apolitical version that only showed up in the 80s. Before that, there was supposed to be no religion, because the Ba'ath Party came about first between the 20s and 40s to address taking back Arab lands from the Ottoman Empire. What was now being pushed forth to Arabs as take back your land to be in the hands of Arabs, even though that for centuries wasn't a problem. So now, in the 20th century, it was about take back the land to be in the hands of Arabs. And because the tie that bound Arabs to the non-Arab Turks was this faith, the Ba'ath Party had to break apart this bind and make the bind based on nationalism. But then, when the Islamic Revolution happened in Iran, there started to be some whisperings of a type of revolution in Syria. And so now there had to be a relief for people's practice of religion from what it was. Before that, and during that time that there were some attempts of a religious consciousness awakening in Syria, one group particularly that some of you may have heard in the news called the Muslim Brotherhood had a big following in the city of Hama. And in 1982... an entire village, with all the women, the children, the non-combatants in that village, was bombed to no existence. Similar to what we may have done in World War II to Hiroshima, but without a nuclear bomb. with just bombarding of bombs, the city was gone. All its residents were gone. And what that did is make people know that any type of religion that wasn't the type that was allowed to be preached was not allowed in Syria. So if you spoke of freedom from oppression, if you spoke of a religion that had to do with decisions that are being made in governance, if you spoke of an Islam or any traditions of the Prophet that had to do with anything that was being done wrong, whether it was poverty or whether it was lack of freedoms for the minorities, anything that would sell that something the regime is doing is wrong, you were not preaching the right Islam. You were preaching the wrong Islam. You were a troublemaker. And you were not given due process. Due process is not a term known. I don't know if there's even an Arabic translation for due process. Because it's not a term known to people who are in the Middle East. When I was growing up as a young man, I spent 7 years of my childhood in Egypt, and I would go back. And when I became a teenager and became a little more conscious of politics, the generation of my parents was highly aware of what was possible to those who became conscious of politics. And the term that was used is that the walls have ears. And if you talk about politics, you may not be seen by your parents the next day. This was a known concept. You ask anyone here that lived in the Middle East for more than a couple of years, that's a known concept before 2011. And now again, it's the same concept in many places in the Middle East. So the religion that was allowed was apolitical, coupled with turning this diversity of religion into divides by allowing those who are of the regime sect to benefit, not all of them, so to only benefit enough of them that was enough to make people believe that one sect was preferred over another, even though the regime could care less about religion. But that's what was used. And again, these two concepts and the balance in our faith of these two concepts, standing up for justice, standing up for freedom, versus maintaining peace, both are highly commended, both are highly desired in our faith, but the challenge is, how do you balance them? And so you'll have people to this day, in every city, in Evansville, you'll have Syrians that will debate that the problem today is because of the civil unrest. And you'll have Syrians debate today that the problem is because of the regime. And you'll have Syrians debate today that the problem is that change wasn't being sought in, you know, a little bit at a time. Whatever change the regime would allow would have been much better than the bloodshed. Of course, in hindsight, everyone and anyone won't say the bloodshed was better. But why should a people imagine that their only choice is that they lose their homeland and that they're executed, or that they accept oppression? The faith doesn't teach that. It taught that there should be a third option, which is that you stand up for your rights while preserving as much as you can the peace. And so that's the challenge, is that you'll have people saying that the maintenance of the peace was not preserved by those who stood up against the regime, and then you'll have those who say that standing up for freedom was what should have been done, and so the bloodshed is on the hands of only one side. And it's really to the analytical mind, the intelligent mind, to look at the facts and to decide. It's not hard to decide with Syria, but it becomes hard to decide in places like Egypt and other places. In Syria, it's clear. And to anyone who doesn't agree that it's the regime that started the bloodshed, it's kind of a neglecting of facts. Before the war, how did religion work in Syria? And this is just a very simplified version. From 1920 to 1947, I talked about that. It was the Ba'ath Party was pushing. And of course, before social media, everyone needs to understand that before social media and before easy connection between nation states, when all of your information was coming from one side only, when a government chose to push a certain agenda on a people, that's what the people knew. And only very few would challenge. And those who challenged became non-existent because they were taken away. And so the news, the information was, from 20 to 47, was that Islam was the problem. And what we needed was not Islam, but many people didn't buy into this. The majority of people wouldn't have bought into this because it was such a core fabric. For the Middle East, religion isn't just something on the side, it's almost built into the culture. to the extent that people who come to America, sometimes they don't recognize what is culture that we used to practice and what is faith, because of the fact that it was just part of culture and faith were mixed together. And then from 47 to 82 was the phase in which the Ba'ath Party took control and was able to maintain a non-existence for the most part of faith, or an existence of faith that was not prominent. Then in the 80s and through the 90s, there became a more prominence. In fact, people from America, people from other parts of the world, would go to Syria to learn Quran. There are specific ways of teaching Quran that are only known from the Syrian community. There's amazing curriculum that can only be learned in Syrian universities related to the faith. All apolitical. And by apolitical, I mean nothing to have to do with social justice. And once you delve into that, you're stopped. Once you start talking about it, you're pulled. To the extent that one of my friends told me a story, he's here today, that there was a small village that had an imam, had a faith leader, a prayer leader, who had a little bit of problem in his community, and they wanted to change him, to have someone else take the lead. So he got a petition signed by people who wanted him to stay. And he took that to the ministry. There's a ministry in every one of the Arab countries that controls the religious institutions. He took it to the Ministry of Religious Institutions to maintain his job. So they told him, that's fine, you can keep your job, but now you need to go to the intelligence services to answer for this petition. And even though it was just a petition about his job, the fact that he got a petition, he got people to have to sign their name to a subject, whatever the subject was, that was a problem. And he was told that if he did that again, he would be out. And by out, I don't mean fired. And then, of course, the religious lines were used to push the uprising and turn the conflict into what it is today. So the question is, what now? And honestly, I try to never end something without saying, what should we do based on this information? And it's very hard to say, what should we do? Because obviously, it's just a devastating situation. But if there's anything, it should be that we start claiming and calling people to, whoever we can influence, that has any say in what's happening, or can be active for it, is that the only way for Syria to be rid of conflict is that all those who are seeing that their sect is the one that has to win have to be willing to not seek that, because there's no way out of such a situation. Now, of course, all of you might agree with me, and then we can't do anything about that, but the reality is that that's the only way out, is to go back to the pluralistic understanding of faith, and to have that understanding of faith not be taken from the Syrian people, but instead to allow that be a part of the process. Because Syrians will never be void of their faith. Will never be void of faith. They'll never be void of the fact that the majority faith that was sort of the undercurrent of the country was Islam. But every sect had this acceptance of the pluralism that was allowed in the faith, and that was changed after the peaceful uprising. Thank you.
After Imam Omar Adia addressed the UE students and the Evansville community, a panel discussion followed with Syrian students joining the conversation. Stay tuned to hear what they have to say about the atrocities committed in their homeland.
Okay, so now we're going to have a question and answer panel. And joining the imam for the question and answer panel, we have four students. We have Ahmed, who is a freshman from Latakia. We have Waleed, who is a sophomore majoring in electrical engineering. He's from Aleppo, and he's one of the co-founders of Scholars for Syria. And then we have Majd, who is from Damascus, and he is majoring in something that has to do with computers. and computer science, and he's another co-founder of Scholars for Syria. And then we have Basil, who is a junior majoring in biochemistry, and he is also from Damascus. Oh, wait, sorry, one more thing. I would also like to introduce the moderator for the question and answer panel, Hannah Richardson. She's a senior, another co-founder of Scholars for Syria, and she's majoring in international studies and business. Thank you. We have some questions right off the bat. Anybody wants to speak up?
First of all, I want to thank you. It is such a difficult task to try to address the multi-dimensional aspects and the historical aspects of this situation. I spent many years in the Middle East, both working as a student and in business, and then involved in public policy in Washington. And I now teach a class at Memorial on the Arab world, trying to raise awareness of the Arab culture, its history, and also the politics and the history between the U.S. and the Arab world. And what I tell the students is, yes, there, you know, Islam is a very holistic worldview, and it is different in that respect than Christianity, where we, especially in the United States, have this tradition of separation of church and state. But the tenets of Islam, some of which you addressed, are fundamentally the same as in Christianity, and there's so much to be respected and for us to learn from that. But my point about the conflict in Syria and the disintegration in Iraq and the very sad situation in Egypt is it's about political power. It's about power sharing and the fact that when the Arab Spring happened, people were peacefully demonstrating to have a voice in their own political and economic affairs. That's all they wanted. And the military dictatorships which existed and still exist in the region wouldn't allow it. So it's so unfortunate for American understanding of the situation that people have chosen to misuse Islam as a banner under which to really what they're struggling for is political power. And they're misusing and abusing Islam to the detriment certainly of them, the people that live there, but also to Americans' understanding of the situation. It's really just what we all strive for, a voice in your own affairs.
And the interesting thing is that when you know, the faith, even when you look at the faith tradition from the first constitution that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, had put together, it was about a pluralistic society. It was about everyone has the freedom and the rights and the protection of leadership to worship, to practice, to live freely, and those affairs that are supposed to be governed privately or in smaller communities, it's a very libertarian, of course I'm not pushing any political partisanship, but it's a very libertarian local politics type of faith. All that is pushed to the people is that you can't allow injustice, and that justice, there's some clear ethics when it comes to justice on a community level, and as long as those are being fulfilled, peace is the number one priority, if those are being fulfilled or if those are being strived for. Because it's very easy to say that, well, one thing's not being fulfilled, so now we need a new leadership. And now, you know, and especially in a situation where you're coming out of nothingness in terms of justice. But the reality is that not everyone in the world has that, and I'm not saying I have this amazing depth of understanding of the faith. I'm just saying that because in America we were allowed to study various things of the faith. We were allowed to hear and listen to, and until the advent of social media, there's people in the world who some traditions of the Prophet, they would have never even been exposed to, unless they were underground studying, you know, getting books smuggled in on certain concepts, because of the fact that certain things were not even allowed. I remember that there was a certain interpretation of the Quran that I had heard about here and had learned from here, and then my wife was visiting Egypt to learn Arabic ahead of, and I wasn't there, and I asked her, and it was not allowed to be sold in bookstores. There was one bookstore allowed to sell it, and it wasn't really allowed to sell it. It was selling as many of it as it could before it was also banned from selling it. So, and this happens. This is a very common occurrence, and it wasn't new to people. So that's how then it was easy for there to be, for people to hear something from the faith and follow it, because their contentions are, they don't have sources to contend with this odd or obscure version of the faith.
If the synod somehow was forced to step down, do you think things would be better or worse? Would there be a vacuum that...
At this time?
Yes. Or in the next year?
I'm going to not answer until my Syrian brothers answer, because I think this is a very tough question.
Well, it's a really hard question. Depends on where the balance of powers is now. So if he steps, let's imagine for a second he really steps down. And then what? We have more than now, because of the foreign countries entering the conflict, we have more than 50 governments in Syria, in each city and in each state in Syria. So it's really hard to unite these people again in one group. So I always had a nightmare about seeing Syria and the Middle East divided into these smaller countries that are based on religion, which it's just like a Sunni country, a Kurdish country, a Christian country, because this is one of the things that are gonna just weaken the Arabic world and my nation as a whole, because if we don't stand together for our improvement and for the good of our nation, then nobody will stand for us, right? So I think, I'm afraid that's what's going to happen if Bashar al-Assad steps down and people want to live peacefully. That's a choice, unless a miracle comes down and just unite people again together and bring the hearts together again after all this blood that took place in the streets of Syria.
I would like to add something to that. Now, Bashar al-Assad, as you can see, is leaving ISIS. You know his power. He's supported by Russia and Iran, which are they're strong. And why is he leaving ISIS? He's showing the Syrian people, like, do you guys want ISIS to come and rule instead of me? Like, do you want me to end them? Like, do you want me to just go down and let them come and show you how to rule you guys? Like, do you want them to kill you? Do you want them to bomb you? Like, I'm better than them. So if you guys leave me, I would end them. But now he's just sitting there and watching what's happening and letting the Syrian people be manipulated by what they're doing. And you can see the media of ISIS. Like, ISIS is showing how they're killing. Like, I didn't see ISIS going to the house of Bashar al-Assad and bumping it. Like, she can do it. They can do it, sorry. Like, they can go and unite and go fight the military of Bashar al-Assad. But they're killing Muslims, they're killing Christians, they're killing many people, but they're not interfering with Bashar al-Assad. So Bashar al-Assad is sitting there saying to the Syrian people, like, my relatives there, my grandmother, she told me, like, do you want Bashar al-Assad to come down and ISIS come and rule us? Do you want them to control us? Do you want them to take our freedom away? Like, Bashar al-Assad is giving us now more freedom than them. He's allowing us not to wear hijab, for example, like as ISIS is doing in Raqqa, if you go see videos of that. So they're like, now most of the Syrian people now are like, no, we would prefer Bashar al-Assad over ISIS. And that's a big issue right now. Like, this is not good and this is not good. But now let's see who's a little bit lesser than they are.
That's what I would add something to them. So now Syria is not unified. As we all know, there's ISIS and Free Army. And Assad's not controlling the big chunk of Syria, so it's only Damascus and the coast, El Latakia. So stepping down might be from my opinion, I don't think it's the best solution, because it will give an advantage to all the other parties or all the other sides to come over and take control of what he left. So there'll be a bigger conflict than the one that we're living now, with Assad controlling at least Damascus, where my family lives. So,
I think he highlighted a very important issue that through the media we might think that Assad is controlling a huge part of the country, but today he isn't anymore. Now, stepping down, he'd have to lose a huge and very important part of the country. The question is, why does he step down? Does he step down because of military pressures from whom? Who is going to take control after him? And that is what decides the fate. Like, we heard reports a couple of days ago that the Saudi and Turkish army are probably going to be in Syria. If they are the reason Assad steps down and they take over, that might be actually a safer solution. The Free Syrian Army, now, they've showed us that they can handle big parts of the country, but they also showed a lack of leadership. So we're not sure we can give them over the whole country. So I think it depends on who gets the country after Assad.
Where does the Free Syrian Army stand on this religious divide? Are they more of a more secular group, or are they specifically geared to a certain sect?
We can say that they're specifically geared to the Muslim Sunnah, and the people who initially started the revolution and lost a lot of their families, so those are the people who joined the Free Army at the beginning. Now it's very varied, very more broad. So,
I mean, there's evidence and information that people who were part of Assad's own military, many of them, you know, became part of the Free Syrian Army. So it's probably a more pluralistic-minded group, while at the same time there is no group is ignoring this sort of religious divide that's been pushed on everyone. But I think, I mean, if anyone who is not comfortable with ISIS like we aren't, and anyone who's not comfortable with Assad like we aren't or shouldn't be, really they're the choice that seems to be closest to what would be a sound choice, at least to for transition. The problem is, like was mentioned, is that there hasn't been a demonstration of that type of leadership, and that's not, and the Free Syrian Army isn't necessarily unifying all the other groups that are not ISIS and not Assad. And the problem, to answer the question about him stepping down, the problem is that makes it complex. I'm not going to give my opinion as to whether it would be good or not, but the general problem is that not just a vacuum, but it's more because the vacuum means that he's actually leading, and he's not really leading anything. He's just imposing military, you know, oppression on a certain swath of Syria, and everyone else is trying to control militarily other parts. So him stepping out, all it will do is now there's a part that is a free-for-all, and that's the part where people have at least used as a haven to some extent, as much as there can be a haven. So now you'll have whatever is left in Syria that is a haven, even though it's not a haven by the definition, but it's a haven comparatively. Now it's going to become just like the rest of Syria. That's what the assumption would be. Unless there's a transitional plan that's agreed upon or control given to another set of forces that are unbiased.
Given the conversation earlier about the coupling of religion and culture in the Middle East, does that make any chance of true democracy a challenge?
So here's my answer to that, and this is a very important answer for every American to be very highly aware of. If we define democracy as a government by the people and for the people, of the people, by the people, and for the people, then absolutely there's a possibility for democracy, because as long as there's a protection of and a process and a transition that can bring that about. And that's, I believe, very, very adamantly that that's exactly what happened in Egypt. What it led to was the Muslim Brotherhood. And what it led to is the polarization, the further polarization of an Egyptian population. So what happened is you had Egyptians now being scared of what they were being told for years and years, and then basically redacting or abdicating what they had fought so long for simply because of fear. And while that democracy might not produce what we as Americans would count as, you know, leadership that's favorable to America, we have to decide what we mean by democracy, because what was being sold as us fighting for democracy before in the Middle East wasn't really us fighting for democracy. It was us fighting for governance that would be favorable to America. And so when we redefine democracy as what we've defined it in our Declaration of Independence and in our Constitution, that we need to have checks and balances, the people need to have checks and balances, non-corruption, or at least no more than what we have in terms of money and power. When we define it as this, absolutely every people are capable of that with the proper training, and as long as it's unbiasedly protected. The problem is, and I guess that's where your question is it possible to be, for that to be unbiasedly protected? I think it can be, but the forces against it are many because of fear, both internal and external. And so I think that's the only solution. I think the other solutions that are talked about are apocalyptic, mythological in some cases, end results. And that's what some people are fighting for. That's what many are fighting for. And the problem is that all that's going to lead to is just further deterioration. So the only option that's sustainable also for the protection and safety of the rest of the world is to try to return the region to a government that's of the people, by the people, for the people, to look for those who are for that within the mix of all of it. And the problem is that there's a fear from the world outside, including our political power here, because of our lack of understanding of the situation, that wouldn't be favorable to us as a nation. In the short term, it may not show to be favorable to us, but absolutely in terms of sustainability of favorability for us as a nation, as an American nation, absolutely, people being able to govern themselves are a lot more likely to not look for finger pointing to outside forces if they felt that they could control. We never look to outside the United States when we have, a clown show in political debates. We look, inside our nation. We never, blame Canada for having horrible candidates that are presenting themselves for president. So I guess what I'm saying is that only happens when you don't have the power as a people.
Also, I want to add to that when really the Syrian people can, all the groups, all the sects, they can sit all together on one table without having any pressure on them from international powers, then they can really make a decision to build a real democracy. When they stop fighting for their own and they start fighting for Syria, then that's where the real democracy can begin.
I want to add to what my fellow said. So at one point in the crisis history, the people asked for United Nations to apply some kind of a election, democratic, peaceful election in Syria, but that was denied by the regime. So, by the progress of the crisis, there wasn't any call for violence. It was peaceful and calling for democracy and democratic election, but we never had it. So, at some point, there were people asking for this. It's not a new issue. It was called for it, but it was denied. So,
thank you, Kai.
During the next days and weeks, Samantha Horton and I will continue to cover this and other interfaith conversations in our local area. This trend was produced by myself, Paola Marisan, and Samantha Horton. Thank you for tuning in. This is The Trend on WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. With your continued support, we're building a better y más fuerte tri-state together. No te vayas.